I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Today, after completing this exhaustive process, I've made my decision. I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence. These qualities and his long commitment to public service have earned him the respect and admiration of leaders from both sides of the aisle. He will ultimately bring that same character to bear on the Supreme Court, an institution in which he is uniquely prepared to serve immediately. Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
That was President Obama yesterday announcing his pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, filling the seat held by Justice Antonin Scalia, who died last month. Judge Merrick Garland had an emotional response to President Obama's decision.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is the greatest honor of my life, other than Lynn agreeing to marry me 28 years ago. It's also the greatest gift I've ever received, except, and there's another caveat, the birth of our daughters, Jessie and Becky.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reiterated yesterday what he had said shortly after Scalia's death. There would be no hearings on any of the president's Supreme Court nominees.
The Biden rule reminds us that the decision the Senate announced weeks ago remains about a principle and not a person. About a principle and not a person. It seems clear that President Obama made this nomination not with the intent of seeing the nominee confirmed, but in order to politicize it for purposes of the election.
Judge Garland is having courtesy meetings with Senate Democrats today. Well, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio are two people to talk about President Obama's selection, the response from Republicans, what it says about the court and our political system. Carol Nakanoff is the Richter Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, where she teaches American politics, constitutional law, environmental politics, and political theory. Author of the Oxford Bibliography, Online's Guide to the Supreme Court. And Carol Nakanoff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Craig Green, and he's the James E. Beasley Professor of Law at Temple University, where he teaches and writes about civil procedure, constitutional law, federal courts, and legal history. And Craig Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I'm a big fan. I'm glad to be here.
Well, nice to have you here. And you actually clerked for Judge Garland. I want to begin with you. We heard him emotionally talking about his family. What's he like?
He really is an amazing legal mind, and I think the way to think about him is really his history. You know, he's been on short lists since 1999-2000 when I clerked for him, and the reason is because his credentials and his record and his integrity really set a gold standard for judicial nominees. Any Democratic president who needed someone who could be confirmed would think of Judge Garland, and indeed this is that time. But he's a really diligent, really hard worker. His record is he's been a prosecutor. He worked the Oklahoma City bombings and the Unabomber for domestic terrorism. And those were really rigorous, demanding, high-pressure, high-stakes legal matters. And he lives his whole life really striving for perfection and trying to make sure that if anybody ever looks back over his shoulder, they'll be satisfied with what he's done. And that's what he instilled in us in law clerks, too. The two things you couldn't be careless and you couldn't be slanted in any direction. It just wasn't tolerated. Those were two things that were very quickly instilled in us.
Carol, let me turn to you and a couple of adjectives to describe Judge Garland. A centrist, a moderate, the least controversial, a safe choice, a consensus nominee. How do you see this selection?
Well, Judge Garland is a moderate, and President Obama had said that he wanted someone who was non-ideological. And I think that does describe, that most people have described Justice Garland that way, that he is very, I would say he reminds me a bit of Sandra Day O'Connor.
Oh, interesting.
At least in the rendition by Cass Sunstein, where she judges one case at a time and is non-ideological, decides on narrow grounds. So I see there's some comparison between Judge Garland and Justice O'Connor.
I noticed the president talked about Orrin Hatch, saying this was someone that Orrin Hatch and perhaps other Republicans could sign on to. Now, we heard Mitch McConnell saying how political this was. Craig, if I can turn back to you, and it's hard to get into the mind of a president or anybody else, but he seemed to pick someone, and maybe liberals are not happy about this, but he seemed to pick someone that Republicans are on record in saying that they would support someone like this.
Yeah, so I think that this is definitely a pitch to whatever moderate Republicans there are. If I could just say, I mean, I think the quote from Orrin Hatch, a conservative senator from Utah, he says, in all honesty, I would like to see one person come to this floor and say one reason why Merrick Garland does not deserve this position. And I think that that's exactly the kind of merit scrubbing and scrutiny that a nominee like Merrick Garland can stand up to. And I think that, you know, it's now he's in some sense more credentialed than ever. He's been on the D.C. Circuit, the second most important court in the country, for next week 19 years. That means he'll have more judicial experience than any Supreme Court nominee since the 1930s.
Really?
He will have more federal judicial experience than any Supreme Court nominee in history. And that's produced a long record. It's not just experience, a long record of making exactly the kind of decisions that Carol was referring to. He has followed the Supreme Court. He has never led the Supreme Court. He has never tried to get out in front of some partisan, controversial issue. He has always tried to do his job exactly the way that moderates and conservatives talk that judges should do, following the law, not making it.
What we hear from Republicans, Mitch McConnell and others saying, which is, let the people speak, let the next president decide who this is. I even heard a quote today that if Judge Garland were the pick of the next president, this would the Senate would go forward and have confirmation hearings. Is the Senate on firm ground when they say basically we won't talk to this guy, we're not going to hold hearings?
Well, it's certainly unusual grounds, but I'm not surprised given how polarized our nation has become. If you look at prior judicial nominations for district court and federal district court and circuit court, the Republicans have been very slow to confirm Obama's choices, and there are still approximately 30 people awaiting some kind of hearing or confirmation vote at this point, leaving some seats open as much as 2 years. This is all part of a foot dragging, but foot dragging would be nominate somebody and we'll get around to a hearing when we get around to it. And you know, but to take a stand that this president ought to nominate certainly is very unusual. I know that the Biden rule was cited, but the Biden rule is just a remark.
Yeah, what is the Biden rule?
Well, there is no rule. When Biden was Senate Judiciary Committee chair in 1992. In a hypothetical, if there were a Supreme Court nomination this year, he said that Bush, he would ask Bush not to nominate somebody until after the political campaign was over. The idea that nominations shouldn't happen in a lame duck presidential election year was a remark that Biden made, which the Republicans are using to tar the Democrats at a moment. However, in the 20th century, there have been an awful lot of there have been a lot of election year appointments, not all successful. Johnson failed, both with Abe Fortas and with Thornberry. Mm. But that was partly because of Fortas's other problems. But the fact is that we've had a lot of 20th century terminal year appointments. I should not say a lot. We've had...
About
a handful, and then others where it was an election year and the person was reelected. So the Senate may have thought that there would be continuity.
Well, I'm holding my trusty copy of the Constitution of the United States in my hand, and Craig, looking at Article 2, Section 2, and it is about the Senate doing or providing advice and consent. I mean, does that mean that the Senate, going back to our Constitution, they are obligated to have hearings and to decide either up or down on a president's nominee?
Well, so I think the Constitution, those words say what they say, and the constitutional framers didn't define them. But I have to say that, you know, I think the opposite of advise and consent is do nothing. And so this, I think I have a little bit of a different perspective from Carol. I think that this is unprecedented, and I'm so shocked at what the Republicans have proposed to do that I almost don't want to believe they'll follow through with it. I think that there have been only two nominees in U.S. history that have failed for Senate inaction, and they were nominated 30 days before the next president took office. So nothing like this. The Biden rule, which you referred to, was in June of 1992. Absolutely, as Carol said, a hypothetical in June, not in February. And I think the thing to know about it is here is not a principle of any kind. It's the principle of because we can. I think the Senate Republicans believe that they can, and therefore they will. And it doesn't have much to do with the Constitution. There won't be a court case about it or what have you. But I think in terms of thinking about a functional government, the Supreme Court nominations have never been treated this way. This is the most important nomination in 30 years because it injects a new level of obstructionism, delay, and politics to the process. Just to be very clear, maybe some people remember Bob Bork.
Sure,
The real message there was that ideology can play a role in Supreme Court nominations. This isn't even about ideology. This is just obstructionism.
Well, they had a hearing.
Exactly so. Absolutely.
And they voted on
it. Absolutely. So I mean to say this is what they're considering and have proposed to do to Merrick Garland is so far beyond anything in our constitutional traditions or history. I just almost don't want to believe it can happen.
Well Carol, and the president said this yesterday, basically, I'm doing my job. You, Senate, do your job. Have hearings and vote up and down on my nomination. I mean, is that out of bounds?
No, it isn't at all. And I think the way we have to understand this, I think it is partly ideological. But, of course, the Senate has wanted to obstruct the president, or the Congress has been trying to obstruct the president on all sorts of things. But I think that I agree with Craig that this is unprecedented at the Supreme Court level. But we are faced with a more polarized court than we have had for a very long time, with an awful lot of decisions being decided 5-4, where that vote matters enormously. So the difference between a moderate Democrat and somebody the Republicans might put forward should they win is certainly going to be significant. And I don't think they want to give away the store, even though it may be unlikely that the Republicans take the White House in the fall.
Well, I know you want to say something, Craig, only but we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the president's nomination for the U.S. Supreme Court. Chief Judge Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. He would be an older nominee than I think some people thought, and certainly has that Harvard Law School background as well. Talking with Carol Nakanoff and also with Craig Green, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about President Obama's announcement yesterday, his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Garland faces an extremely difficult, maybe even impossible path to this particular job. Almost immediately after Obama's announcement, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declared there would be no hearings on this nomination. And we are talking with Carol Nakanoff, political science professor at Swarthmore College, and Craig Green, professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, about this selection, about the process, about the response from the critics of this process. 1-888-477-9499. Craig, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Sure. I think Carol is making a very good point about people saying this is a very important nomination because the court is divided largely on a lot of important issues, 5-4. And I just wanted to mention, as some of your listeners will know, that actually came up with Judge Alito. Justice Alito, when he was nominated, was to replace O'Connor. That was a huge shift to the right. And Obama considered and tried to filibuster that nomination on the grounds that it would shift the court to the right, radically shift the court to the right. Well, he voted to filibuster, and Biden, of course, in 92 had talked about things, but senators talk about things and they try to vote on things a lot. I think the thing that's really remarkable about this nomination is there's a possibility that Senate Republicans will actually block a nominee. And that's a remarkable turn of event in federal courts. And when the justification is actually not so often the 5-4 split in the court, but somehow the general political turbulence mm-hmm. of our times mm. and of the political election. And I think that has to be almost really paradoxical, the idea that because, for example, just to say a name, because there's Donald Trump or because there's a circus in a political election, therefore the court should be rendered dysfunctional and therefore someone who is unquestionably judicially qualified should be blocked, a remarkable event. I think that really takes things to a new level and sort of mixes dysfunction with function and really seeks to destroy. I mean, I think it's an amazing turn of event, a really amazing turn of event.
Well, I wonder too, Carol, if this Judge Garland is the moderate that people say, I mean, is there any evidence that he would ally himself with the more liberal parts of the court? I mean, we might be getting ahead of ourselves but
I don't think we know, Marty. There is some evidence. Well, first of all, if Judge Garland were confirmed, it would shift the center of gravity of the court a little more, some more toward the center. And so perhaps he would become a swing voter. Justice Kennedy has been holding that mantle, wearing that mantle for a long time. But when you say making the court dysfunctional, I'm not so sure that, I mean, one could strategically say, why should there be a 9-member court anyhow? After all, it's only by convention that it is 9. The original court was 6 members, and so a majority plus 1 and 2/3 is exactly the same. So did the founders intend for things to have to be done by a supermajority or just a simple majority? We don't know. But in 1869, the court became 9 members, and it has stayed there ever since. What would be the impact of an 8-member court? Well, it could be paralysis, but think about that. Is that something that conservatives might like? In other words, you've got 4 Democratic appointees, 4 Republican appointees, and that means you wouldn't take certain kinds of cases if you can't reach a decision. The Federal Election Commission, just to draw an analogy, is set up so that to deal with campaign finance irregularities and violations of law. There are 6 members, and no more than 3 can be members of the same party. Now, that board has not functioned. That's more dysfunctional. But an 8-member court might be able to function. There's no reason to say it can't. It might be less active.
Interesting. Go ahead, Craig.
I think I do have to disagree a little, and maybe your callers will want to know about the 18th century court. But in the 20th, 21st century court, one of the most important jobs the Supreme Court does is it resolves the toughest cases that are circuit splits. So one set of federal courts go one way, one federal courts go the other way, and the Supreme Court decides the difference. Now, in those hardest cases, which are the most important issues that the Supreme Court does, the modern court does, it's very important to reach a decision, to reach a result. And 4-4 is not that. And so it may be that for almost an entire year, and depending what happens with the new president, maybe longer, and depending how long this principle of because we can allows this kind of obstructionism, it could be longer than that. And the idea is that this branch of government, the most important work that it is able to do, which right now are resolved almost all by 5-4 decisions, very many of them in the area of gun rights and religious rights and abortion rights and all the things people think about, free speech rights, all these sorts of things, the court just won't be able to operate. That it won't be able to do that function with 8 justices. And I think that, you know, it's a testament to how we've gotten used to, haven't we? We've gotten used to the idea of obstruction and conflict and impasse with Congress and the president. And, of course, I think at the top of your news hour, the governors and state legislatures across the country. I think it's really a testament to how dysfunctional we've become sort of immune to the idea of thinking of, well, maybe if the court takes a year off from its most important cases, how big a deal will it be? But I want to just say one more thing, which is that I think the precedent this sets is even bigger than the year. This sets for the next set of nominees and how far this principle of because we can goes in the future is actually more important even than the year. Because this, I think, signals that any time any Senate group, whether it's a filibuster or it's a committee, can block any, even the most credentialed, unquestionably qualified and talented and philosophically moderate justices, if they can, then they will. If they can, then they can. And I think that is really outside the traditions of our constitutional order. And it says something about who the next nominees will be. It says something about who they should expect to be. It says something about how they're supposed to feel when they're on the court. If they're a political football this kind of way, then I don't know how they're not supposed to feel the same kind of patronage allegiance that we would think is horrible for a justice to feel toward their nominating party.
You know, Carol, I'm thinking that a president's ability to nominate someone for the Supreme Court and then for that person to be approved and passed and then sit on the court is really one of the most consequential things that a president does. I mean, it extends well beyond their 4 or 8 years.
Yes. While the average length of service on the court is only 16 years, in the 20th century, it has been much longer. You've got Justice Kennedy, who's been there 28 years. You have Thomas, 25 years, and with many more probably before him, Ginsburg at 23 years. And Breyer at 22 years. I would like to say that I do agree that the just because we can obstructionism is not likely to end with an election. I think it's very possible that if there were a President Hillary Clinton and she nominated someone even moderate to the Supreme Court, that the Senate may do the same thing.
Not hold hearings or?
Well,
or
they might. They might. And it depends. Should the Senate be retaken by the Democrats, that might change the calculus a little bit. But
what you're saying is this is very political.
It is very political. And you're right that we've faced Congresses that have refused to act on legislation. This Congress a little less obstructionist than the 113th and 112th, but still. It's been a pattern during the Obama years that's gotten much more exacerbated than it had been before.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We've got Bobby from Delaware joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Bobby. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi
so
there.
I think that the process needs to work, and that when somebody's nominated, that elections have consequences, and Obama's still the president, he gets to nominate who he wants. What frustrates me, I think, is listening to the two of you talk about this being some sort of, you know, we're going to soft pedal the fact that Obama wanted to filibuster. We're going to soft pedal the Biden rule. We're going to act like Schumer didn't, you know, stand as an obstructionist in many court nominees over the years, more district level than Supreme Court level. This is not new. This system, this process has been political for so long. And the fact that I have to listen to this is some sort of Republican thing that they came up with, I don't know. I think Chuck Schumer kind of started it back a long time ago.
Well, Bobby, hold on, only because I know that Craig Green wants to respond to you.
No, I want to say that on one level, I agree with the caller 100%, and you can trace it farther than that. Before they called it the Biden rule, they called it the Strom-Thurmond rule from 1968. Which is a Republican, which is just another example. And the caller is absolutely right. I think it's a really important point. If you look at speeches, not only can you find Biden and Obama flip-flopping, but you'll find the Republicans flip-flopping too. So Senate Majority Leader McConnell making exactly the opposite. Like they trade speeches as they walk in from one election to the next. The only thing that I think I really want to be stressing, and I think this gives me occasion to do it, is that's talk. And this is action. And I think that it's right that Schumer has failed to block other nominees. The Supreme Court is different. It's right that Biden didn't succeed with his hypothetical rule that never affected a single nominee and never came to fruition. And it was wrong. I think it is defensibly wrong to think that Obama was wrong in applying the Bork rule. He was applying the Bork rule. He thought Alito was outside the ideological mainstream. But I think all of this is different because there is no argument that Garland is outside the ideological mainstream. That's the new part. This is not an argument. This is a liberal extremist. This is an absolute centrist who's getting blocked for totally collateral reasons. That's the new part. That's the only thing I think I would add to the caller's point.
Bobby, do you want to add something? And then we'll go to Carol.
Sure. That's because Obama's smart. That's why he nominated this person. I strongly believe that he would have rather have nominated somebody that's ideologically left. But he knew in this process that he would politically look better if he nominated a moderate. I think the country is going to be better for it. But this is all political, and to act like it's anything other than all political, I think, is what frustrates me, because Obama's not like, oh, I feel so strongly that I should put a moderate on the court. He's doing this because he knows he will look better. This person is clearly very qualified to be on the court. You know, I think if you look at certain areas of his opinions, like, for instance, his support of the NLRB and other areas, I think it's clear that he is considered to be more ideologically left than right. But he certainly is within the area where it would be difficult to stand up against him.
Well,
and
fair
so
enough.
Obama is smart to nominate him.
Bobby,
this is all political.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Carol a chance to respond
just,
to that.
Quickly, Obama's belief in bipartisanship is real. I mean, it cost him, but he certainly believed that both sides ought to work together, and I think this nomination reflects that belief genuinely. But polarization, also, you're right that there have been instances of each party doing this, going back to the increasingly polarized Congresses of the late 1980s. So this is not a new phenomenon, polarization and attempting to block the agenda of the other party. But it has moved to an extreme.
Is it hurting the institution of the court?
I think so. I think that, of course, if Garland is stonewalled, then I think the caller will be right and there will be nothing but politics anywhere to be found anywhere. And I think Supreme Court nominations had been different. I think Garland represents, at least for some of us and maybe for the president, a dream that law can be more than partisan politics, that judicial excellence can be more than what will you do for me and my team, and that Supreme Court nominations and the institution will be more than just a political football. But if Garland, if even Garland, can be blocked for this kind of very flimsy just-because-I-can principle, then, of course, the caller is seeing into the future. And that's what future nominees will be. And I think it's true what she also said, which is that, there could be 100, maybe 1,000 judges, much more left-wing than Obama. And we should expect to see them from a President Clinton if she were the president. And we should expect to see something very different from President Trump. But it's true that heretofore, 4 years was 4 years and not 3 years. And in terms of actions, I think this represents a real fork in the road.
There was early on, Carol, this notion that a lame duck president shouldn't be allowed to have their nominee for the court go through the process. And there was this definition about, so what is lame duck? Is it the last year of a president's office or is it the last month after the election? This would be in 2016, would be November. Is that an issue, you think, as we grapple with all of this?
Well, historically, lame duck presidents have made nominations, including successful ones. Hoover nominated Benny Cardozo in 1932 and then went on to lose the election, but Cardozo went on the court. In 1912, Taft nominated Pitney to the Supreme Court. Pitney was put on the Supreme Court, and Taft lost to Wilson. There were LBJ, as I said, did not succeed. Four other election year picks in the 20th century went on the court. William Brennan, Frank Murphy, Clark, and Brandeis all went on the court during election years. So it is certainly assumed that a president has a responsibility to make a nomination. And as Craig said, all those people received hearings.
And vote. I mean, have the vote.
Well,
right?
There's an even more recent example, which is Justice Kennedy was nominated in November of 1987. You know, in the court. I mean, the argument is the election mechanics are all. Well, a candidate, Gary Hart, had already dropped out and was back in the race by that point. You know, it was in the middle of. You can imagine November of this past election. It would have been just as partisan as it is now. And I think in a world where election cycles are getting longer and longer, the idea, oh, we can't have a Supreme Court nominee when there's election cycle, the year of an election, 2 years of an election. I think this is a real erosion of presidential power through practice. That I think is really distinctive and very troublesome for the court and for the functionality of government and the law.
I think that when Ruth Bader Ginsburg did not step down at the end of the in June of 2014, I told my students Obama will not be able to get a court pick. In other words, I assumed he was a 2-year lame duck, and that is because of the. Because of this political stalemate we have.
Let me get Ken from Lansdale to join our conversation. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you, Marty. Regarding Mitch McConnell's reference to the Biden rule, and he said that phrase four times in his remarks yesterday, it is actually a complete mischaracterization of Biden's remarks. Biden was not recommending the course that the Republicans are now set on, but they don't quote that part of the speech that they don't want you to hear. He was actually telling the president, George H.W. Bush in 1992, that if he offers up a compromise nominee, then Biden will support him. And that's in the speech. It's available on YouTube. I can tell you.
We know all about YouTube. Yes. No, thanks.
Okay. No, but I mean, okay, but as I say, that's, so this characterization that Joe Biden was trying to tell this thing to do is a total mischaracterization of what he was trying to say.
Well, Ken, it looks like Craig wants to respond.
No, I think that may well be true. I think the two things that I really want to stress that I think are even more important are, number one, it was a hypothetical, and it never actually came to fruition. And if we know anything from any political season, it's that senators make a lot of speeches about a lot of things. And what they do matters more. And the second thing, I think this goes along with Katie's comment, too. As long as the American people understands that this is not about the Biden rule, and it's not about constitutional principle, and it's not about preserving the court or bringing it out of political madness, but rather throwing it into the gumbo. I mean, this is, the constitutional principle is because we can. There's nothing else to it. The Biden so-called rule, as this caller is suggesting, is the weakest fig leaf, really. This is raw political power, and it's being brought, as we've seen it in many other contexts in life, it's being brought to what some people might have thought was the last vestige of the possibility of some kind of nonpartisan political law. And Merrick Garland is the man for that kind of conversation, because he has lived his life trying to live up to that ideal of law. And if indeed this Republican Senate and Republican senators reject that possibility, I think they send it, all of us, a very clear signal about what the what they think the court is and what the court is likely to be in the future. I think there's a real danger here of changing the game.
Carol, I know you want to say something, but you have to hold on. That's only fine. Because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we are talking about President Obama's nomination for the U.S. Supreme Court, an announcement he made yesterday. Judge Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Mitch McConnell said yesterday what he has said before: there will be no hearings on this nomination. The next president will decide the next Supreme Court justice, according to McConnell. 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about President Obama's selection of Judge Merrick Garland to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court and the reaction to that. Our guests are Carol Nekanoff. She's the Richter Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, teaches American politics, constitutional law, environmental politics, and political theory. Also with us is Craig Green, and he's the James E. Beasley Professor of Law at Temple University, where he teaches and writes about civil procedure, constitutional law, federal courts, and legal history. A lot of people that want to join the conversation. But, Carol, I want to just toss something back to you, which is about Judge Garland. And, I mean, it looks like his path to the Supreme Court is, if not blocked, unbelievably circuitous. Is he a kind of a sacrificial lamb, do you think?
Well, I don't think Obama would like him to be a sacrificial lamb, but I think that is very possibly what he will be. I know that Senator Flake has said that he would meet with him, I believe, but the other Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, I haven't heard anybody say they would. I cannot imagine, after they've taken such a strong stand that they will not hold hearings, and that Mitch McConnell is backing them up, that they are going to hold hearings. So I don't think it's likely that Judge Garland is going to join the Supreme Court. Mm. I've heard a scenario, which I don't think will come true, that should Hillary Clinton get elected, the Senate will rush to confirm because they think they could do worse. But I do believe that at that point, Justice Garland would withdraw, or President Obama would ask him to withdraw so that Hillary Clinton could name her own nominee. That's a possibility.
I mean, is he a kind of a political football?
So
Craig?
I think if he's a sacrificial lamb, to use that term, it's not just him. It's the court. It's the law. It's the process. It's the constitutional order. But I think if you think of it from President Obama's perspective, he had two choices, basically. He could have tried to pick a gold standard credentialed pick that would try to appeal to someone like Orrin Hatch. and Lindsey Graham. And honestly, I'm shocked that Senator Toomey from our state has taken a very strong stance in an election year in a moderate swing state. But he could have gone for someone like Garland, who would appeal, was thought to, hope to appeal to the what he would call the angels of our better nature. Mm. And the idea that there might be some compromise and bipartisanship even in these troubled, turbulent times. Or he could have picked someone that would fire up the liberal base. And he didn't go that route. That was a political option that he had. And I think in this sense, it's an optimistic, to borrow a term, hopeful pick that Obama has made, a hope that the Senate Republicans, like senators of the past on the Democratic side, will at some point come to their senses and behave well for the Constitution and the country. But I think the sacrifice really is us as much as it is Judge Garland and the country.
I was wondering, what would Scalia do, or what would Scalia say? I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know what he would say, but with his view of the Constitution and the court.
The best Scalia was someone who believed that the court was best when it was least political. And Obama has tried to pick an apolitical choice, and the Senate Republicans are considering making an unprecedentedly political decision that will make the court and nominees, I believe, very dangerously more political than it ever has been in American history. So I have to believe that from that side of things, although he wouldn't necessarily agree with Judge Garland and his views on this and that, I think that in terms of institutional structure, I have to think that someone who believed what Scalia believes would be only one side of this issue.
Let me get some callers in, and I'll toss that to you, Carol. This is Holly from Middletown, Delaware. Holly, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. I am so – well, just a comment and then a question. I am so, so angry. I don't recall being this angry about a Supreme Court nominee named Clarence Thomas, which was arguably, I think, the most political and cynical appointment to replace Thurgood Marshall. But – what I'm wondering is Professor Green, you had mentioned at the outset that this wouldn't necessarily warrant a court case or something like that. But if the failure to hold a hearing is basically not advising and consenting, it's doing nothing, why would that not warrant some sort of a suit against Mitch McConnell to make him do his job if he is acting unconstitutionally?
Well, Holly, it's an interesting question, and I'm trying to do equal time here. So let me toss it to first to Carol, and then I'll see what Craig has to say.
Well, the Supreme Court historically is very reluctant to get involved in fights between branches of government. I think that is one reason why they would not take up such a suit. And the question is, who has standing to bring it? I can't imagine the court, if some Democrats in the Senate banded together to try to sue, the Supreme Court has in the past said, well, you're just sore losers.
But could a citizen? I'm just speculating here.
I don't think so. It has to be somebody whose interest is aggrieved. And they have to stand out from everybody else who breathes the air, to use Scalia's term.
What do you think, Craig? And then I'll read some comments here.
So I think I think there's nothing wrong with being angry. I think that's what I would say. I think this is but I think the thing to know about the Constitution as much as anything else is that sometimes it's up to us. That is to say, sometimes it's not the courts, it's the democracy that has to stand up for the structure of government. And the principle, because we can, will be the law in the future. The words advise and consent don't say what has to happen in terms of hearings. There's a long variation of historical practice. But if the American people, in this time of political turbulence, when there are a lot of other issues on the table, if they're willing to make space and say, actually, we care about this form of delay and obstructionism, like the caller does, you know, there are mechanisms for that, and they're not courts, they're letters, and they're not courts, they're emails, not courts, they're phone calls, you know, and there are ballots, you know. I think that it's very hard for people like maybe us who specialize in courts, who feel like this is such an important issue, to get on the airwaves and get on voters' minds. But I think that if indeed the American people declared this is unacceptable, it would be unacceptable. And I think that's another principle of democratic constitutionalism. That's what I would say.
Anything you want to add to that, Kim?
Well, voters this year are very angry about a lot of things,
yes,
including
are.
The dysfunctionality of government. So here is a prime opportunity for them to say so if they don't agree. The only problem is a vote doesn't convey a very clear message. There are many reasons for which people vote. And even if they throw the incumbents out, that doesn't necessarily say on what it is that they expected them to do. So to ask the American people to weigh in on who's going to be the next Supreme Court justice is a little, I suppose, disingenuous in the sense that not only do most people not know who's on the Supreme Court, they know some cases or decisions they dislike, but they don't know the justices and can't really vote at that level.
And you might be voting for someone and you don't know who they're going to nominate for the court as well. Let me read some comments here. Email from Mary. Perhaps we should remind Mitch McConnell that President Obama is our president, elected twice by we the people. Email from George. Conservatives fetishize the Constitution, yet now they walk on it. Republicans are destroying our institutions. An email from Matt. My question is it possible for the executive branch to sue the United States Senate in the Supreme Court? I think we touched on that earlier. An email from Mike R.E. Senator McConnell's outrageous justification for the obstruction of the Garland nomination. The Senate is the voice of the people. So we're hearing some of the voice of the people as well. Did you want anything to
add? Yeah, I just was going to say, I think that in political times, we have some idea that courts are supposed to be different from some of these other dysfunctional branches, and the Supreme Court most of all. And the idea is that the courts are open to hear your case. And I think putting aside the longer-term consequences, this delay means that for the hardest, most important cases in America, the message is basically, sorry, Charlie, we're a judge down, come back later. And I think that that's unacceptable to some number of folks. And I think that but it only will be if the American people say they will be. And I think it's true, votes are hard to figure out, but letters aren't. And, you know, I think that, you could see a lot of examples where people can make their particular voices heard on particular issues by contacting. And I know it sounds maybe naive about electoral democracy, but every letter people say is worth 1,000 votes. People sort of read them that way. And I think that people have to make their voices heard.
Let me just throw some recent court decisions on the Affordable Care Act. However you feel about the Affordable Care Act, the Heller decision about guns, Citizens United campaigns and money, marriage equality, affirmative action. I mean, these just as a kind of reminder about the important decisions that the court has made and probably will make in the future. Let me get Barney from, looks like Lahaska, to join us. Hi, Barney. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. Two quick points. The Republicans don't really believe the position they're taking. It's totally disingenuous and hypocritical. Imagine if this was the last term of President McCain or President Romney, Justice Scalia dies. You don't think that they would be pushing and saying under the Constitution that we have a right to nominate and approve a judge? Secondly, what if the November election takes place and the Democrats win the presidency and they win back control of the Senate? Would the Republicans in a lame duck session be able to change their mind and say, hey, you know what, we're gonna hold hearings for President Obama's nominee, and we're going to approve him rather than have Hillary Clinton and a Democratically majority in the Senate pick somebody much more liberal?
Well, I mean, it seems, Carol, there are risks for the Republicans, I guess, in if they decide not to have hearings or even approve Judge Garland, because as you all have described, this is a moderate selection, not a liberal by any stretch of the imagination. If things switch either in the White House and or the Senate,
well,
what happens?
Unless they lose a lot of seats, they still are probably going to be in a position to block. And so
this would be the Republicans in the Senate.
Exactly.
Right.
So if they're determined not to do anything, they may still have that capacity. Yes, I mean, I could imagine a scenario we talked about where Justice Garland's name is still languishing and they decide all of a sudden this is the best we're going to get. But I do think in that circumstance that Obama will ask Judge Garland to withdraw.
Well, I'm trying to imagine, Craig, let's say the Senate committee, Mitch McConnell, holds true, says this is just we're not going to do anything. I mean, how long does this sort of hang out here, and how long does Judge Garland not be confirmed?
It's such a good question, and that's the part that really could get to be historically unprecedented, because only two in their trivial cases in American history have failed simply for Senate inaction, people 30 days before the inauguration of the next president. But I want to return just to one quick point from the caller, which is that I think that the principle really is the because we can principle, and I think we should all remember what Katie said earlier in the show. It is true that Democrats and Republicans swap speeches from one to the other. But I think that in the spirit of dreamy imagination, okay. I'd like to imagine a different principle, which is if the Senate has time and if the nominee is good, maybe the principle should be they should get hearings and they should get a vote. That principle actually has been the practice of the Senate since the 18th century to today. And today really is a pivot point, and it's different from speeches, and it's different mm-hmm. from Schumer and Biden and Obama, because it really could make a difference. And no one will ever talk about Bork. No one will ever talk about Bork if Judge Garland goes down. Bork will be irrelevant. We'll only talk about the wrongdoing taking place in the Garland confirmation. And I just don't want to see that. I don't want to see that to the court or the country or the law, because, of course, the Supreme Court really is the oracle of law. This is not the first political tumult we've had.
Sure.
2000 with Bush v. Gore, when I was working for Judge Garland, we were talking about what's the role of law, and the court was deciding effectively an election. And I want you to know that in our conversations, we watched, like everybody did, we watched those news reports all the time. For him, it was never political, and it was always legal. When he talked about Bush v. Gore and what should be done with Florida elections, he always focused on the legal. And that's why, again, I think he's in some sense the perfect candidate for us to be having this conversation about. Does anybody believe in the possibility of some form of credentials and record and integrity as transcending the immediate partisan politics of the day? I think that's the question before the country.
And have a vote, Carol, and then let the Senate decide.
Right. Well, Mitch McConnell said to hold hearings would be to waste the Senate's time. I'd like to know what else they're doing that's so vitally important that they can't hold hearings. I think that's, we know that these Congresses have not been that productive. So I don't see what's so much more important on their agenda than to do this. I think, however, that Mitch McConnell is getting a clear signal that the other Republicans on this committee are not going to let it out of committee. In other words, they're not going to hold hearings. You've got quite a few very conservative Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, including Ted Cruz. And I don't think that some of these folks are going to budge.
We're almost out of time here, Craig, but I mean, is the risk for the Republicans that if they had hearings and then had to vote and had to vote down Judge Garland, that I think everyone agrees is a very centrist, safe, non-ideological choice, that then they're stuck with that vote?
That's exactly right. I think the Garland nomination is going to set a precedent for the future one way or the other. The principle, because we can, and just an absolute stonewall, absolutely unprecedented. But if, in fact, the Senate votes down a sitting four-year term president, which the people had, I mean, we had an election where there were consequences, we do every 4 years. If the Senate then decides that he's unqualified, that they should vote him down, what person in America can ever count on being qualified in the future? I think this would set a new standard well beyond Bork. Since the Bork for the last 30 years, the idea was if you're in trouble and the Senate's against you, and then you nominate someone like Judge Garland, and you don't get all the ideological benefits you want, but at least you have a really solid pick. If that strategy doesn't succeed, then I think it's very hard to see what comes next.
Well, to be continued, we do have to end our hour. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Craig Green, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Carol Nakanoff, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And she's political science professor at Swarthmore College. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Many calls, many comments that we could not get on the air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.